This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Improving young doctors. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Summer is the time when many new doctors are making the rounds as residents, but they're sometimes afraid to ask for help. Here's what some hospitals are doing.
On the tech front, do you have a box or kitchen drawer full of old smartphones and tablets you no longer use? We'll have five modern uses for them.
Looking for a career or trying to redo the one you have? We'll identify the most dangerous jobs in America.
And how to keep your social media free of your friends' political rants.
Twitter is the vein of my existence because Twitter does the retweets, right? And so everybody retweets everything. And during politics, like right now the Olympics, if you load the Olympics, you're going to know everything that's going on pretty much instantly because everybody's retweeting everything.
Luis Villalobos at the Arizona Republic on keeping Facebook friends but ignoring their politics. He's here later in the hour. Well, one of the interesting stories about Team USA at the Rio Olympics involves women's wrestling. A Colorado woman named Adeline Gray is projected to be the first American female to win gold. The 25-year-old is the reigning three-time world wrestling champion competing in her first Olympics. She's also got a job pitching DeVry University, good for her, right, where she earned a degree in technical management and a concentration in project management. She's with us from Copacabana, where she'll compete this coming Thursday. Adeline, how'd you start wrestling?
My dad was a wrestler, and that's how I got into it at 6 years old. I got into the sport and fell in love with it, and I've just been so thankful that I've been able to find new heights with it within USA Wrestling and Team USA.
Wow. What was it like in school or I don't know, around town? Did people say, oh, Adeline, listen, wrestling's for boys. You need to be a cheerleader or a softball player or something like that?
You know, it's really interesting. I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I didn't have very many people that told me no. I had a very supportive system and coaches and teammates that treated me as an athlete when I stepped onto the mat, and it wasn't until I got into kind of the international circuit when some of the old Russian coaches came over and were like, you're too pretty to wrestle, and I'm looking at them. I'm like, I've never been told I'm too pretty to do anything. I don't understand why that would stop anybody from doing anything. And so it just was a very eye-opening experience to kind of finally be told that I wasn't supposed to be doing something. I thought this whole time that I was just supposed to be going out there and working hard and working towards my dreams of becoming an athlete. And once the women's wrestling got put into the Olympics in 2004, becoming an Olympian. And now I've accomplished those goals, and I just kind of hope that women all over can see that this is an important thing that you can dream about.
You seem to embrace that, kind of being the face of this movement.
It's an amazing spot to be in. I mean, it's just kind of timing, honestly, pairing up with my success of my peak of my career and then also having the ability that the movement of the world. I mean, we have women's pay, we have a president nomination. I mean, there's so many kind of girl power things that are happening right now in the world, and in with my life in particular, I see how much I lacked not having that dream and those role models when I was younger, and I want that to change. I'm living a fantastic life right now, and this is a life that people should dream about, that young girls should dream about, and that's something that's very important to me, that young girls look up to people in my situation and people in the soccer players and Carrie Walsh and different things like that, and see that women can be professional athletes, and we can dream about being athletic past high school and past college and getting our degrees and making sure that we are being, you know, powerful, strong, beautiful parts of our society.
We're speaking with Adeline Gray, U.S. women's freestyle wrestler. She's in Rio competing at the Olympics, getting ready to compete. All right, so you mentioned soccer and volleyball. Were you at times like a woman on an island trying to find people to wrestle growing up, since there seems to be so few in your sport?
No. So wrestling is actually one of the fastest growing sports in the United States for women. And I competed against the boys from the age 6 all the way through high school. And I was on boys varsity my freshman through junior year. And then my senior year, I won a junior world championship and got asked to move to an Olympic education program, which was all girls up in Northern Michigan University. And went up there and learned freestyle and came back and ended up making six senior world teams, winning 5 medals, 2 bronze, and 3 gold. So I've just had a very good experience learning wrestling and being treated as an athlete and getting to focus on making myself as fast and as strong as I could be.
Mm. So you mentioned wrestling in high school. Did you have to wrestle boys all the time? Was there ever a girl you could wrestle?
My sister was on the team, but she was much smaller than I was, so I just competed against boys through high school. And they were, I owed so much to those boys for stepping on the mat with me. I think it shows a lot of respect that I was out there training and competing. And those boys, they understood that I was doing this for the same rights that they have. Boys have the right to pursue an education and athletics, and I, as a female, deserve that same thing.
Yeah.
And those boys allowed me the opportunity to get very good at the sport.
When you tell people that you're a wrestler who you don't know, do they sometimes say, oh, like with John Cena and the Bella Twins on WWE?
Yeah, I have people hand me chairs quite often, and I never really understand it because I've never really watched WWE or the fake wrestling. And I just, I'm going to have to sit down and watch a couple episodes because I do have a lot of friends who are very into it. But it's a very different sport. You know, that's
yes.
An entertainment field, and wrestling is more of a combat competition.
Let me ask you this. So for parents who are listening, or maybe young women who are listening, why would you say wrestling is good for girls?
I think wrestling is good for people. I think that wrestling teaches you how to work hard. It teaches you how to persevere. It teaches you so much about being on a team, but also being by yourself, which is so much of life. I mean, having a team and supporting you and having that support system is very important. But a lot like life, when you step out onto that mat, it's all about you. The decisions that you make, win or lose, it's going to be your fault. And that's something that wrestling teaches you to a core.
Thanks, Adeline. Adeline Gray, U.S. female wrestler. She'll compete next Thursday in Copacabana. Oh, by the way, she may not watch WWE or be that familiar with it, but she recently got some love from Dwayne The Rock Johnson on Twitter. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Everyone knows that business is all about numbers. Consider the numbers the state of Michigan can offer your business, like Michigan being one of America's top 10 states for business. Or 2000, the number of burdensome regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6, Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climates, which all adds up to the one state that has all that and more. Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Thanks for being with us. Hey, to hear a podcast of our weekday program, please visit our website, which is ThisMorningWithGordonDeal.com. You can also check out places like SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and tune in. In hospitals, this is the time of year when newly minted medical school graduates start their first year of residency, taking on patient care with very little hands-on experience. For patients, that means a visit from a doctor who might look young and untested, perhaps even nervous. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landro says to make sure residents ask for help from a senior doctor, more hospitals are developing formal escalation of care policies with clear guidelines. Laura set this up.
I think maybe if you're going to the hospital in July, you might be worried, or you may have heard of something called the July effect. And that's supposedly when the new residents come in and they just got out of medical school and they're really kind of training on the job. And there have been some studies that have indicated that, or actually showed, that the errors and risks to patients actually spike in that period. Now, some studies have shown that that's not the case, but there is a lot of evidence out there that communication breakdowns between residents and the attending physicians who supervise them are the cause of a lot of problems in healthcare.
Wow. All right. Like what, for example, kind of breakdowns?
Well, just different kinds of things that they should escalate to someone who knows a little more. So maybe they're overconfident. Maybe they think that they know what to do. Maybe they're not sure what to do. And sometimes they feel intimidated about calling on a attending physician because there's an old adage, I know in the surgery area, for example, that you can call me, but calling is a sign of weakness.
Oh, boy.
So there's a lot of different factors. It's very complex going into the education of a medical resident and the training. And one of the concerns is, how do we make it clear to them and to the doctors that supervise them that these are the things you have to escalate care for? This is when you need to notify a senior doctor. And in fact, there have been some research at the Harvard-affiliated hospitals that showed that when they had these communication standards and they gave these literally a pocket card to wear, you know, on their badge with here's 15 things, 15 reasons that you should call on a more senior doctor, that this has actually really improved communication and gotten patients more care from attending.
Oh, how about that? All right. So besides a little card, I guess, clipped onto your ID, what else is being done?
Well, basically, I think it's kind of trying to change a culture. You know, the culture is even if they say this, they don't really mean it. You know, that's very much the culture. So I think what you're seeing is the message has to go from the very top. The chief of surgery, for example, says to the attending doctors, we've told the residents that if a patient needs a blood transfusion, if a patient has to be transferred to the ICU, if a patient has any one of these issues that could signal a worsening condition or a risk to the patient or a possible infection, that you have to be called. So when that resident calls you, don't bite his head off or her head off. Mm. And basically, it's the chief of surgery. All these changes have to come from the top down. You know, you can say to the residents, don't worry, you should call. But if you don't tell the senior doctors they're going to call, then there's going to be a problem.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Her piece is called A Better Safety Net for Young Doctors. So the patient's role here, you touched on a little bit, should be what? If they see somebody young, do they say, hey, are you a resident?
Well, I think it's always important to know who's on your healthcare team. First of all, they should always be introducing themselves when they come into your hospital room. You know, I'm a nurse, I'm a physician's assistant, I'm a resident, I just started my residency. And you can always ask as a patient or family member if you feel that you're not getting adequate care or if you're concerned that someone doesn't know what they're doing or that someone needs to be consulted who might know a little more. You have to say, I'd like to see the attending, or can you call the doctor on call? You know, one of the problems is you have to get these doctors, they have to go through a period where they have to be trained to practice medicine independently. They've already learned pretty much everything there is to learn in the medical school experience. Now they're coming in and applying all that learning. And yes, it's, you know, it's that kind of period, maybe the first year residency, where they're still, you know, maybe they haven't actually stuck a, you know, needle in someone's vein just at this point, or they have seen something about this in the medical class, but they haven't seen it on a patient. So yes, we have to give them some autonomy. That's a balance that has to be struck between giving them enough autonomy and giving them the responsibility to take care of things and saying, you don't quite yet have the chops to do all of this. You need to call on a more senior colleague.
Is this at all, Laura, tied to new penalties against hospitals?
Well, look, I mean, I think in a way, everything is tied to new penalties against hospitals. If you have patients who have infections, if you have patients who have to be readmitted, you're going to get penalized. But there's so a lot of rules and regulations out there governing, you know, the kind of issues that that hospitals, you know, can get dinged for on their payments. But I think the most important thing is that this is finding ways to get good new doctors, give them autonomy, but also make them understand responsibility and make them understand their own limitations.
All right. Thanks, Laura. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. It's time now for a finance update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Come as a guest, leave as a friend at Lexington Inns and Hotels. We'll treat you to exceptional service and hometown touch. Visit LexingtonHotels.com. As Americans, we are, by most measures, horrible at saving, except when it comes to reward points, it seems. Unfortunately, Kelly Grant at CNBC.com says that's one time where waiting for a rainy day may not be a winning strategy. Kelly, explain.
We have been hearing that more consumers are hanging on to their rewards points. The estimates from SwitchFly.com, which is a rewards platform, is almost 200 billion outstanding loyalty points, miles, and other sorts of loyalty rewards, which is obviously quite a lot. So you want to be thinking about what might mean you're hanging on to these points and how you can best use them.
Mm. All right. So give us some guidance here then.
Well, the first thing is, I mean, there are a lot of factors that could lead to some of this outstanding point balance. Some of it is that people tend to, you know, join programs and then not really with the intent of earning or using points. They're looking for these other perks. So that's at least some of the outstanding balance. Some of it is also that these points are hard to use. And then you've got the people who are really saving up and they're saying, I want that free airline ticket, you know, the heck with the, you know, redeeming my miles for the magazine subscription. Yeah. So that's why, you know, various people might be saving. You know, I think depending on which category you fall into, you want to be really plotting out what's the reward you're going for, how long do you think it's going to take you to get there, and how much are you going to have to pay to get there in terms of just the cost of earning all of those rewards and the cost of redeeming them.
All right. And some of these programs, I mean, are kind of deliberately complicated, right? Aren't they meant to be a, I don't know, to try to deter you from cashing in?
Some of them are deliberately complicated. Others are inadvertently complicated. And then we always hear with airlines and hotels, too, periodically they undergo these changes that essentially devalue a lot of your points or miles that you've earned. That's really another reason why it's not a great idea to hang on to these, is you might be suddenly much further away from getting that free airline ticket. So you want to have a sense of how fast are you really earning up these miles or points. You know, is it realistic that you're going to get those Beyonce concert tickets, or should you be settling for something that's a little bit of a faster payoff?
All right. We're speaking with Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. Her piece is called Saving Reward Points and Miles Isn't a Sound Money Strategy. All right. Somebody used the phrase earn and burn. What does that mean?
Earn and burn, a basic idea of you want to always be thinking about what's the reward you're going for and, you know, how do you get there and how do you then come up with another goal. You want to be always thinking about those points and miles balances as something that, you know, it's an active thing. You're not saving it like you would a savings account or a retirement account.
It's hard to keep up with this stuff, though, and because there was one person in the story who said, you know, you got to pay attention to these things and the changes. I mean, how do you keep up with that?
Well, you just want to be paying attention to any mailings or emails that come your way from these different programs pointing to changes that are upcoming. The good news is, at least usually, it's not going to be immediate, you know, hey, this change is going through tomorrow. You're going to have, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months in some cases to figure out your best strategy around those changes. And they're not always going to be bad things. We saw American Airlines, for example, they recently changed their award chart. So depending on the seat that you were going to go for, some of them actually got cheaper. Most of them got more expensive if you were looking for like a high-end reward there. But sometimes that can work in your favor. And having that extra time gives you a sense of whether you want to maybe accelerate your spending, switch programs, try to burn through those rewards, or just continue saving and so that you can take advantage of those new terms.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. It's 30 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend, mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office, and it's so easy. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. The setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in DEAL. That's Stamps.com, then enter the code DEAL. Again, visit Stamps.com and enter the code DEAL.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, managing your Facebook friends who post the worst political stuff, the most dangerous jobs in America, and simple new uses for old smartphones and tablets that are just sitting in your kitchen drawer. Those ideas in about 20 minutes. Well, the U.S. men's gymnastics team has failed to medal at another Olympics, finishing fifth in Rio last week. Same result as 4 years ago in London. Japan took gold, by the way, followed by Russia, then China. Meanwhile, why can't the U.S. men attract as much attention as the U.S. women's gymnastics team? They continue to be starved for attention and are trying different ways to get it. We take you now to Rio and Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnovsky. Louise, they're just not as great as other countries.
They do okay, but they don't win like the girls do. And one of them also pointed out to us that that was probably the number one thing that they could do to get more attention. But they have medaled in the past, so they show that they have potential. They haven't clinched it recently. But there's also this ongoing question, even if they do win a medal, not necessarily a gold, they might not become the same kind of household names as Shawn Johnson or Nastia Lukin or the other women's gymnasts, Gabby Douglas, Ali Raisman, who win a collection of medals, many of them gold, some of them not gold, at past Olympics and then go on to do Wheaties boxes, Sports Illustrated covers, all of the stuff that you associate with the sport that is, for many viewers, the marquee event of the Olympics.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. Anybody kind of from the outside speculate? Well, we just love our female gymnasts.
There's plenty you can speculate about why it is. You can point to a long line of very popular women's gymnasts in the U.S. going back to, for example, Mary Lou Retton, who people remember. It's certainly been this way through the 80s, through the 90s, the Magnificent Seven in Atlanta, yeah, and into the 21st century. So the U.S. men feel like they have to do something a little bit more creative to get themselves on the radar.
So what is it, I guess, they hope to accomplish, let's say, if they, you know, were seen more on the radar?
Well, they want to point out, particularly to the fitness industry, particularly to all the people who are interested in physical exercise, that they have incredible bodies from the workouts that they do. They're doing a sport that's incredibly difficult. We also talked to a Dutch gymnast, Epke Zonderland, who has a viral video from his high bar routine in London in which he, this is incredible, releases the bar, catches the bar, and then does that twice again in direct succession. An incredible feat, and he recognizes that what he did there was enough to make people stop and think, huh, maybe there's something about men's gymnastics. In the Netherlands, he said, the Dutch women's team also overshadows the men's team there.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnovsky from Rio. Her piece is called U.S. Male Gymnasts Want to Be Objectified. They're looking for more attention. Have they tried anything new in terms of trying to get attention since arriving in Brazil?
Well, we asked them. They've worked very hard since they arrived in Brazil. They skipped the opening ceremony, so one of the things that they missed there was somebody else who decided to go shirtless in the name of bringing a little bit of attention to his team, the Tongan flag bearer.
Right.
Certainly not a lot of people talking. We have a separate story about him and his backstory on WSJ.com. But, you know, we asked the U.S. men if they'd seen this or what they knew about it. They hadn't seen it. They've been getting ready for their first day of qualifying on Saturday. But they're sorry they missed it, and they feel like they're brothers in bare arms.
Right. Very good. Well, so speaking of bare arms, what about competing with their shirts off? Didn't somebody float that idea?
Well, somebody did float that idea. That doesn't appear to be part of the regular competition rules. They typically compete in sort of a singlet top, yeah, and shorts or tights, depending on the apparatus that they're on. They are aware, by the way, that people make fun of them for wearing the tights. That's also something that they bear in mind. But they figure at that point, if they're making fun of them for wearing tights, what's the difference between making fun of them for that and making fun of them for going bare-chested? Right. You'll see them bare-chested in a lot of their training pictures. At previous gymnastics events I've been at in the U.S., there's often been a photo montage or a video that's also been shown on a jumbotron of them in these kind of poses. It's something they like to do a lot, and they do it a lot.
Have they used Instagram or their social media to kind of further their cause?
They do. You'll see. People want to know why we didn't run a lot of pictures with this story. I would say that, you know, you don't have to get very far on Google in order to find all that you could possibly want to see, if that's what you want to see.
Thanks, Louise. Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnovsky from Rio. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. How much of your Facebook feed right now is full of political nonsense that just aggravates you? Also, how much of your Facebook feed is now filling up with friends saying they don't want to see political posts? How to manage it all from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
TMI. When it comes to social media in this presidential election year, some of us are finding out a little too much about the stances of our friends and family. How do we stay friends but ignore their politics? Louis Villalobos of the Arizona Republic has some tips. Louis, why is Facebook the biggest offender?
Well, the reason why Facebook is a problem is it has figured out a way to show us what everything our friends are doing. So if you like something, if you become friends with somebody, if you share something, if you like somebody's page or an organization's page, all of that shows up on our screen. So anything our friends do, you see on your stream. And sometimes there may be stuff you don't necessarily want to see.
All right. If you don't want to see that stuff, what should you do?
Well, you can go to people's profile. So say one of my friends, I have a lot of good friends on Facebook, like I'm sure all of us do. You can go to their profile and you can unfollow them. And so if you click on their, you have there where it has your friends and little options you can do with your friendships. You can customize friendships with people. One of the things you can do is you unfollow them. So when you unfollow them, it removes your feed. It scrapes your feed from anything they do and anything they post.
Can you selectively get rid of stuff that they post?
You can't, to answer your question, but that would be the dream. Like, I would love to have gone into some of my friends and got rid of topics. Topics would be the best thing to do. What you can do, though, is if you have a friend who shares a certain website or a certain link from a website or an organization consistently, you can click on that item. So if somebody shares something from, say, the Washington Post, and it's something you don't want to see, a topic you don't want to see, and they're always sharing Washington Post stuff, you can click on that item up on the top right. There's a little arrow. Click on it, and it gives up a menu. And one of the menu items is to not see anything from that organization being shared. I might be wrong, but you can only do that on desktop. So you'd have to go on desktop to do that bit.
Okay. Should you block people or drop them?
See, that's the thing. I've gotten those questions before. And the reason why you can block them, and block them is something that a lot of people do, but if you're going to block them, you might as well just drop them, right? Because then, you know, but I don't drop people because it's very awkward when after this storm of politics passes and you want to get your brother back or your father-in-law back on the page, right? You have to go friend them again. Then you have an awkward conversation of why did you unfriend me? And that's awkward. I'd rather just passive-aggressively unfollow them.
Okay, so they definitely know if they get dropped.
They know if they get re-added. They don't necessarily get a prompt if they get unfollowed, but if you want to follow them back, you get a prompt. So when somebody adds you as a friend, you get a request, and you know that this person is adding you back.
Okay, Louis, what about Twitter? How do you manage that one?
Twitter is the vein of my existence because Twitter does the retweets, right? And so everybody retweets everything. And during politics, like right now the Olympics, if you load the Olympics, you're going to know everything that's going on pretty much instantly because everybody's retweeting everything. So the biggest thing to do on Twitter is to turn off retweets. And you can do that if you click on a profile, and you can do this on your phone or on desktop. If you click on a profile, there's a little cog kind of on the top right. You click on that cog, and one of the options you get is to turn off retweets. And a lot of people know you can do this. So all that does is whoever you're turning off the retweets, you will never see their retweets again. It's pretty magical.
And what is the mute function on Twitter?
Mute works the same way as unfollow on Facebook. So if you mute somebody, you just don't see anything they do, anything. No posts, no retweets, nothing, but it still keeps you as Twitter friends or Twitter followers.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Louis Villalobos from the Arizona Republic. 13 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. It's easy to take workplace safety for granted, especially since the Occupational Safety and Health Administration laws protect workers. But according to a new CareerCast report, some of the most vital careers to upholding and maintaining the very fabric of American society are also among the most dangerous. Here's a list of them from Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. Kyle, give us a few.
Well, one of these that kind of stood out to me the most is veterinarian was kind of an interesting one. It wasn't the top in terms of the most time lost due to injury or illness, but the fact that it ranks so highly is pretty surprising because you think of going to the vet, taking your small dog or whatever. And, you know, it seems like a job where you're able to help animals and you know, kind of nice, safe work. But in reality, things range from dog bites to if you work with horses or livestock being kicked by a, you know, obviously huge animal.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really kind of a dangerous job, especially for those that work with the larger animals. But then, you know, in human healthcare, nursing assistant is one where you work long hours, you're exposed to people who have illnesses. So it kind of makes sense that your immune system might wear down and you would lose time on the job due to illness that way. And then, you know, obviously there are some ones that really are pretty obvious, you know, firefighter and police officer. Obviously, those are two jobs where risk and physical danger are inherent.
Yeah. Boy, going back to general care, at least a veterinarian, you're getting paid if you're getting kicked or bit or suffering scratches, unlike a nursing assistant, right? Explain the average salaries there.
Yeah, with nursing assistant, you're looking at a not great average salary there. You know, obviously registered nurses are going to make a little bit more because they have to put in the extra schooling. So on top of being a more dangerous job, you're also looking at a lower pay there. Now, for some of these, the pay really isn't great. You know, something like a taxi driver or a truck driver, those aren't particularly high-paying jobs, and you're taking on a lot of risk as well.
Mm. We're speaking with Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast. We're looking at their list of the most dangerous jobs in America. All right, what else jumped out at you?
Correctional officer is an interesting one. Again, you're talking about law enforcement there. And that, you know, when you're working in an environment with prisons, correctional facilities, you take on a lot of risk that isn't necessarily as spotlighted, I guess, as you could say about police officers also there in law enforcement. So that kind of jumped out at me. But something that I found interesting was that some of these jobs, despite being dangerous, there are steps being taken to improve the safety of them. Like truck drivers, for example, federal government in recent years has instituted stricter guidelines in terms of how many hours per week you can work, to try to cut down on drivers getting on the road with fatigue. Cab drivers, the rate of violent crimes committed against cab drivers has dropped significantly in the last 15 years or so. So there are steps being taken to make some of these jobs less dangerous, but something like firefighter police, it's just going to come with the territory of those jobs.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. So here are the 10 most dangerous jobs: construction laborer, correction officer, emergency medical technician, and a 24% growth outlook for that profession, by the way, farmer, firefighter, nursing assistant, police officer, taxi driver, truck driver, and veterinarian. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Got a box or kitchen drawer full of old smartphones and tablets? You know you're not going to sell them. So Wall Street Journal tech writer Jeffrey Fowler came up with a handful of ways to put those old tech devices to modern use. For one, how about a security system? Internet-connected cameras like the Nest Cam are popular for checking in on family and pets or alerting you if there's a burglary in progress. An old phone running on Wi-Fi can accomplish the same thing. Number two, an alarm clock. There are apps like the $2 Wake for the iPhone that offer a gentle rise, and it doesn't blare with notifications in the middle of the night like your current smartphone. Number three, remote control. The best universal remote is one that's smart enough to know what's on broadcast TV and streaming. A free app called Peel, P-E-E-L, does it with an old phone or tablet that just needs Wi-Fi. Number four, picture frame. If you've got the original iPad, why not just use it as a way to show family photos? Prop it up on a shelf, plug it in, and open a photo album and tap slideshow. And finally, a car TV. Even a first-generation iPad can still play movies for the kids as they travel in the back seat. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.